He also lived right there on the campus in a house that he owned until recently. He sold it to Washington Lee since I was on the board. I mean, so 7 or 8 years ago, maybe, or less.
Well, it seems that many of the faculty were right there. Well, was there socializing with the faculty
as
well?
Oh, sure. I mean, not in the sense of, I don't remember, faculty members who invited students just on a purely social basis, but often, many times you invited the faculty homes in the company of other students. And that was, you know, it was terrific. You really would get to know some of these people. And Marshall was like that. There was another teacher, George Foster, who also lived right there on the campus. He taught
Korean. I don't know that name. Who was he?
He was in the English department. I forget what his scholarly areas were, but he had the one creative writing course. And he was also a very warm teacher. He enjoyed being around students. You know, there are a lot of teachers who do not enjoy being around students. But that's not true generally at Washington Lee, which makes a huge difference. And he had I don't know if this is the talk of mine that you heard on tape or not, but if it is, I don't want to repeat myself. But, in my junior year, I took his creative writing course, and we met at the Dutch Inn, which is still there, I believe. And we had a little room in the Dutch Inn. There were about 10 of us, as I recall, in that class. And the another student in that class was William Hoffman. Does that name ring any bells? He was a veteran who had graduated from Hampton Sydney. And he had another year on his GI Bill. He had been through about 5 years of combat in the Second World War. So he had everything you could get in terms of the GI Bill. He had another year, and he decided to come to Washington Lee and just spend a year there. And he was a writer, an aspiring writer, and so he was also in this. And we had to write continually, which is really the best part of a creative writing course anyway, it's a vehicle to force you to write. And we would read our stories aloud. You didn't have Xerox machines in those days. And we would read our stories aloud, and they would then would be criticized by the other students and by George Foster. Mm-hmm. And those were wonderful sessions. Bill Hoffman was by far the best writer in the class. He wrote some short stories about the Second World War that I can remember to this day, which he developed into a book that was quite successful called The Trumpet Unblown, a novel that was highly praised, the New York Times, Time, Newsweek, everybody. And I really think this atmosphere could not exist at any place other than someplace like Washington Lee, where instead of having God knows how many people in the creative writing course, which would be true at a large university, you had a small group. You constantly heard each other's work, and you had somebody like George Foster who was very with whom you could talk not only during that class, but you'd see him on campus, you might be at his house. I think there's a lot of reaction now against the big university where there are big names who are a little more than that to the students. They're academic stars who give a big lecture, and that's the last you see of them. Washington Lee's teacher-student ratio is very low. He's down to 11 to 1 now. Mm. And that was probably about like that at that time also, which is a tremendous advantage. And also you did a lot of writing, not just in something like a creative writing course, but there were just constant papers. And I think teachers are can put up with a lot of writing if there are not so many students. Anyway, that was all very valuable for anybody who wants to write. And I'm trying to think of, there was one other person in that course, I'm just blanked out on, who also became a published writer, a novelist. And that's 3 out of 10, that's batting 300. It's a very high average as far as creative writing courses. It's extraordinary average.
Pretty amazing, really.
Yeah. And that small community, and the closeness to the faculty, the small classes, is really the ideal setup, I think. And,
were there other people in the English department who were important for you?
Not like Foster Fishwick and and Dean Labor.
I understand that there were just certain people who were giants, and people practically genuflect when they say their names. And it's, I just think that's a wonderful legacy for a school to have.
Well, they probably are. But I particularly, if you're talking about academic giants, I particularly remember Labor, and I'm sure there were many others. And just as great as a great teacher and then budding academic star, and then who went on to write, he'd already written several books, I think, Marshall Fishwick, and he's written many books.
How about on the social scene, where things like that, there wouldn't have been a mock convention when you were there, right?
Oh, there was one.
Oh, right.
There was in 48.
48? There was one. It was 44, there was one during the war, of course.
So it was 40. Yeah, because I remember going to it. And.
Did you get involved?
No, not at all. And politics bored me then, and politics bores me now. Mm-hmm. It has always bored me as a writer. And that's because this country is so stable.
We need a good revolution.
This country is so stable. You know, we think we get a left-wing president, we think we get a right-wing president, and all it is a railroad train going down the track, and there are people shouting on either side of the tracks and trying to push the train, and they can't even rock it. It's just kind of... if you think about... Roosevelt on the one hand, you can't imagine how left-wing he was perceived as being, and Ronald Reagan on the right, and how, you know, this term that's used now, there's no such thing as the right anymore, there's only the far right and the extreme right. The right disappeared, there's only the far right. Well, Reagan was considered, you know, one step from Hitler. But to all of my friends in New York, believe me, in the journalistic and literary world, they thought he had a black mustache under his nose. And look back on it and think of how middle of the road his actual regime, what he actually did was, and for that matter, what did Roosevelt do? He didn't lead us under the some red banner, shrieking down the streets. It was pretty, and given the crisis that he faced, it was pretty, for the most part, pretty sensible Band-Aid stuff. That I'd get a big argument on that, but. You know, politics in this country is like a 108-inch sofa. And you just can't move it. You kind of want to move it, you know, it's in the wrong place, but it's just too much of an effort. And it's so boring to write about it. I mean, how can anybody get excited about this election coming up, 96? Plenty of people do, but I cannot get excited about it, particularly since now we're the only superpower in the world. And it doesn't matter who you put in the White House, it really doesn't. Don't let's get off on that.
Well, I'd love to, but we are supposed to talk about Washington and Lee. How about things like fancy dress? Did you go to fancy dress?
I never went to fancy dress, and I get requests from the fancy dress, the students who are involved in it, for reminiscences of, I never went to one. And I avoided as much as possible fancy dress, football rallies. Oh, I hated football rallies.
And they were big then, right? That was the time of big time
yes,
football.
Yes, and I think here's a part of the wisdom of James G. Leyburn. Washington Lee embarked upon subsidized football. Not just football, it was also a subsidized wrestling team. And that was rather more interesting. But subsidized football, even if you have the money to do it, is a dreadful mistake at a place like Washington and Lee. Because you end up, wherever you have subsidized football, with a mercenary army on your campus. People who have come to your campus, not because they have any interest in anything that your school might stand for, or because they might be part of any social heritage. I mean, that, why was I at Washington Lee? Because I was a Virginian and more or less in the social swim of Washington Lee. But they're just mercenaries. And at a place the size of Washington Lee, they stand out to...
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, they tend to go around in clumps together. And why shouldn't they? I mean, that's their fraternity, really, is sports. And it's true at every place you have subsidized athletics. I don't know exactly where they were quartered at Washington Lee, but often such students room together, they eat together, they socialize together, and it's very natural. There's no reason why they shouldn't. Mm-hmm. But they are so often like a mercenary army in that they're looking to play professional football. That's really what, or whatever the sport may be, that's why they're there. And it is a very bad thing for a place like Washington and Lee. And I think Dean Leyburn recognized this. It's something he inherited, it was much he could. But as soon as the first opportunity arose, you'd have to check this out with somebody else because I wasn't that close to the administration at that point. But, he was the one who said enough, and it was the best thing Washington Lee ever did. Subsidized sports are, even in the biggest university, are a dreadful mistake, just an awful mistake. And we're playing that game out now. There is something, you know, there was still something known as amateur sports when I was at Washington Lee, and there's a very sound theory behind amateurism. Sports are a charade for war. They've always been that. And the idea is to put young men, and it has nothing to do with women, I'm sorry, it's just the truth, is to put young men through a simulation of the combat of war in a harmless or relatively harmless way. And to simulate combat and perhaps learn something about the teamwork of war. And the greatest fighter is always going to be the amateur, the one who fights for honor, for home, hearth, blood, and honor. And that's why there was such a premium put on amateurism. That, and there was a little bit of social snobbery about that too, but that you're an aristocrat above being paid. But mainly it's the idea that the amateur fighter is the great fighter, because the amateur will fight even after the game is lost, as was proved in many, many wars. And it's interesting that every adulteration of that with professionalism leads to the instincts of the mercenary. What is the mercenary? The mercenary is in it for money, and he expects pillage and rape as his reward. And that's one of the natural results of professionalization of the charade of combat in sports. That's my opinion. I'm really so happy that Washington, and you know, there are always pressures to get back into that, the professionalization of college sports.
Now that shift happened out of professional, big league football in 1954. Were you aware of that as it was happening? How did you, once you left Washington and Lee, I know you have in recent years maintained an interest. Did you maintain an interest? Did you come to alumni reunions all through the years?
No, I really didn't. I would somehow follow what was going on, but I really didn't. I went off to Yale, and then I went off to Springfield, Massachusetts to work on a newspaper. And even when I was in Washington, working for the Washington Post, I was not involved in. Somehow I kept in touch. But
when were you on the board? What
year? 84. I think my first meeting was the fall of 1984.
Yeah. So you were involved in the co-education decision?
Well, I was not there for the vote.
The vote
was in the spring, as I recall.
In June.
Something like
there
that.
There was a special meeting in June.
And I came on the board, I was sworn in the fall meeting. So.
I'm really sorry. I'd love to have your perspective on that.
I never considered single-sex education as a tradition at Washington and Lee. It was a given. When I was in college, the exception was the co-ed. You know, people would talk about a co-ed. That's a woman who was in college with males. That was something somewhat unusual. Even the University of Virginia at that time was split into two campuses. They weren't even close to each other. The female part of the University of Virginia was Mary Washington College, all the way across the state.
Mm-hmm.
So, and for that matter, all the Ivy League colleges were all male. It was just true everywhere. It all began to change in the late 60s and during the 70s. There were other places that were co-ed, obviously. But I didn't think of it as a tradition. It was just the way things were. So that never, as far as I could see, it wasn't much of an issue. I mean, there were other things. I considered getting rid of conventional dress a bigger, more drastic change than bringing in women.
Were you aware of that as it happened?
Yes. I mean, I remember seeing some pictures, photographs of the campus. What has happened to that place? By this time, I was really in favor. I really was indulging my own taste in dress, even while working on newspapers. I had no other minor vices, so I was, getting clothes made and all this other thing. I really hated to see Washington Lee lose that classy look that it had always had. I mean, there used to be fabulous tweeds at Washington and Lee. Some of the greatest tweed jackets you'll ever see in your life. Many of which would have looked better if the students had also worn chocolate brown Borsellino hats, but that was too much to ask for.
What do you think now when you go back and see all the women there? It's fine with you? Is having women on campus an acceptable thing?
Oh, I think it seems to me it's turned out marvelously. Now, I was on the board as coeducation began and progressed, and clearly Washington Lee has attracted a superior what's the word, cohort of that is not the right word, of superior group of women. And what's amazing is how little disruption of the atmosphere of Washington and Lee has occurred as a result. And it certainly seems to have done wonders academically, in that not only were there women who were very bright and who score very highly on the SATs and all those tests, but it also seemed to attract a better male student in terms of academic qualification. Incidentally, has anyone, I'm sure they have, but just ask anyway, brought up the fact of how many business leaders are Washington Lee graduates?
Please talk about it.
I was really going to ask you if you know exactly how that has come. It was quite striking. There was I think Washington Lee ranks, as I remember, just below Yale and ahead of Harvard in the percentage of graduates who become CEOs of Fortune 500 companies.
I hadn't heard that. Is that true?
It is. And this was published in Forbes not long ago. And I really don't know exactly why it's true either. Of course, there is a business school at Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether that has to do with it or not. I really do not. I'm more curious than anything else, but it's quite striking. And
were you aware of that when you were in school? Were there a lot of people who were aimed towards business?
Oh, there were. A lot of them were people whose parents were very highly placed. I'm sure that's still true. And who would recognize at a very early age their son's business acumen and make them vice presidents at the age of 24 or 25.
Yes.
But it's really quite something. And I gave a party here at Washington and Lee's request for some people in New York who were very highly placed in business. I don't have the, I don't know, I could find the list somewhere of all those people. It was quite amazing. And then I read this piece in Forbes.
I'll have to track that down. That's something I should.
Would it be
aware
worth
of?
Worth looking at?
Well, I feel like we've gotten some wonderful material here. Is there any way you'd like to sum things up, or are there any topics that we haven't talked about?
Oh, another thing that I, you know, as it was also a, in terms of athletics, which interests me a lot, it was a place where it was very easy for somebody to be a walk-on athlete as long as the sport was not subsidized. My passion was baseball, and I was on the Washington League baseball team, had a very undistinguished career, but it was something I loved, very undistinguished, but I was on the team. I just walked out there and tried out. I'm not sure I would have even attempted that anywhere else. And this was pretty big time baseball. Washington Lee was in the Southern Conference at that time. Mm-hmm. And that was a very fast league. Washington Lee was in Southern Conference in all sports, and which was...
I haven't heard anyone talk about baseball.
That was big time college sports. And that's another of the great advantages of the place. It's not just that it's small, but there is a real sense of community. And I don't know where else you'd ever find that. There must be somewhere else. You know, you would know the name of practically everybody in the campus. You may not really know them personally, but you know their names. And there was the greeting custom, what was that called?
Speaking tradition.
Came very naturally. You know, you try to describe it to somebody outside of Washington Lee, and it sounds artificial and forced. And
oh, I've been trying it here in New York for the last 24 hours, and it works.
Well, people like it. I mean, you're right. They like it in New York. People like it anywhere, but it really worked, and you really did, and you were expected to speak to people, even if you just spoke to them 10 minutes before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. You know, it really does increase the sense of community. And so this went into everything. There was this feeling community in the classes you took, as I was trying to describe the way you feel close to these teachers that you had. And the social daily social life on the campus, and even something like sports. You know, you were not an alien if you just decided to walk in from out of the sky onto the...
What position did you play?
I was a pitcher. I now wish I had tried out for the infield, because I think I was probably a better hitter than a pitcher. But I was a pitcher. And at that time it meant... You know, I had the American male disease, which is the abnormal and inflamed desire to become a sports star. And if I could have become one, I don't think I'd ever written a word. if I could have played Major League Baseball, who cares about writing? My class prophecy in the Southern Collegian, which was, I don't know, does that still exist? I don't think so.
The Southern Collegian died.
It died
a sorry death.
That's what one has to call the so-called humor magazine. My class prediction was that I would be a great left-hander for the New York Yankees after graduation. The humor there was that I was right-handed.
That's wonderful.
Actually, that was a pretty humorous class prediction, I thought.
That's great. I like that. That's great.
But you know, when all is said and done, it's the I think it is the sense of community. And for all of my misgivings about fraternities and all of that, it's all part of it. It's so unusual because it isn't just the community of students having their own social life, but it also has to do with faculty, it has to do with sports, it really has to do with everything on the
That was the thing that I did go to Fancy Dress this year, and I was so struck by that sense of community of the students and the faculty and the administration all having a grand time partying together. I don't think that happens many places.
And I think it's one reason that a lot of outstanding faculty who are wooed by larger institutions will stay there. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, right now Washington Lee has one of the great neuroscience centers in the country. And that's the hottest area of academic life in America right now. There's nothing approaching it. And that's the, you know, that's the future intellectual battlefield of America, is the neurosciences. The American, what do they call it, Society of Neuroscience is one of the fastest growing professional associations in, of any sort in the whole country. And Washington Lee is at the, with this tiny
and it's
psychology
getting better
department
too.
Is at the forefront of that. You know, young philosophers are in droves heading into neuroscience. It's partly the lure of nihilism. The neuroscience underneath has a very depressing message, which is, oh, I love this subject, which is that the fix is in, that we're all wired a certain way. Because you know, the great figure in it right now is Edward O. Wilson, who's at Harvard, who says that every human being is born an exposed negative, like the negative in a camera. And you can develop it well, he says, or you can develop it poorly. But no matter how you develop it, you're only going to get what's on the negative. And so many parents now think this is true. And that's why people pay attention to rather nonsensical concepts such as attention deficit disorder. The same child who supposedly has this disorder and can't learn in school will watch Nintendo for 4 and 5 hours at a, at a stretch. This is not attention deficit, it's a deficit. But, most such children need a camp counselor who will kick them in the slats. And,
yes, yes, I agree with you on that. You mentioned the Southern Collegian. Mm-hmm. Were you involved with publication?
Oh, yes, I should mention that. This is another great thing about being involved. Maybe I would have been involved wherever I was, but I wonder. My passion was sports, as you can see. But, so I was the sports editor of the Southern Collegian. I was the sports editor of the Ringtum Phi. That thing's a great name for a newspaper.
Do you know what the heritage of it is?
No, it's a. I'm sure it was a joke on the, all these fraternities. And there was another thing. It was in a song called talking about college life, and somebody's a member of Delta Hand Apoco. So there are a lot of these plays on words. And I think Ringtum Phi, you know, was the same kind of thing, probably. And then the English people on the English faculty, plus Marshall Fishwick, decided to start a literary magazine called Shenandoah. What they really had in mind was a Kenyon Review. The Kenyon Review had tremendous literary status at that time. Because this was the era of the new criticism, you didn't need a huge research facility to come up with a major literary magazine. It was the era of reading of the text and so on. And so the faculty started, English faculty, but they realized quite accurately that it had a better chance of being launched if students were involved. So they created a troika editorship, and I was one of the three. And I can somehow dredge up the other two names if I work on it. I don't know why I can't remember who they were. And I published two of my own stories in Shenandoah. The first one was about sports. It was called about, and then another one, which was about a boy and a girl who are sitting on the bus from Richmond to Lexington. I used to go back and forth to Richmond on the bus, Greyhound bus, and they become interested in each other and so on. And that was great. That was great fun. Later, it became less and it became less gradually less and less of a student publication. Bill Hoffman, incidentally, if you ever look, I don't know how much far you want to go into all these things, but if you look back at Shenandoah, there are some outstanding stories by William Hoffman in Shenandoah. Well, fairly soon it became like Kenyon Review in that it was no longer a student publication. It was a national literary journal.
Is that okay with you?
I think it was a mistake, personally. I mean, but I'm prejudiced because I enjoyed my student involvement in it. But there are other literary magazines must have come and gone. There was one, I don't know if it's still going or not, it was founded fairly recently, Ariel, A-R-I-E-L. Mm-hmm, is that still going? I think Joey Dye's...
I don't know, I see it on campus.
Started that. But Shenandoah became quite a highly respected magazine, and outlasted the Kenyon Review by a lot, and the Antioch Review and all those things.
So Shenandoah was going at the same time as the Southern Collegian? By that time, Southern Collegian was just a humor magazine. And I shouldn't say just a humor magazine.
No, well, it was just a humor magazine. There were other things in it, but that was its purpose. And, you know, that's an old college tradition.
It's had a very... The Southern Collegian changed a lot through the years. I've been looking at a lot of the early issues, and through the years it changes. It's quite a different publication.
I didn't follow it, so I don't know what happened with that. And because now there's the Spectator, and there's another magazine of opinion, isn't there? A liberal magazine? I should know. I think there is.
Well, there's the Spectator. There's the Trident.
No, well, the Trident
is the newspaper.
Second newspaper, which I think is a great height. I mean, the more competition in journalism, the better. I think there's also a liberal magazine, if I'm not mistaken. That's a good development. That sort of thing wouldn't have happened anywhere when I was in college. Almost nothing took place outside of the official orbit at any university I'm aware of. And I figure the more the merrier. Yeah.
So, do you feel that experience you had working on the Ringtone 5 helped lead you into the career, and you went into journalism for?
Oh, sure. No, that there was a gave you a taste of it, and meeting deadlines.
You
and
just love those deadlines, huh?
But it was easy to, it was really pretty easy to get into those things if you wanted to do it, which is another good thing about Washington and Lee. And I sense among parents that I know here in New York that there's more and more of a reaction against the big universities and that increasingly people are looking for the sort of thing that Washington Lee offers. And Washington Lee's conservatism has been a great blessing in a lot of areas. For example, the look of the campus, it remains a stunning campus that has resisted the fads, and it, you know, Harvard is almost comical now. You know, the campus looks like you have one of each of this year's style of the century.
Same way at Princeton.
It's a lot. It's also a lot of that at Yale, not as much as at Harvard. But Washington Lee is, and there is remains, I think, much more sense of civility at Washington Lee than at most places.
And, would you encourage your daughter to go?
I would certainly encourage her. I think I may have mentioned, sophomore in high school, and she hasn't expressed any inclinations in terms of specific. I would love, I mean, if she would like to, I'd love for her to.
Has she been there? Has she seen the campus?
She has been there, huh? And I've taken her. She loves horses. She loves riding horses. Mm-hmm. And I've taken
good her area for that.
Taken her to the horse center, and mm-hmm. we've seen some shows over there. So, and I have a feeling she would like that scale of college life.
Well, it's a big tradition of generation after generation going to Washington and Lee.
That's true. And now they use, in those pictures they take each spring, the fathers and the daughters as well.
I think those pictures are so charming.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll get old with me after a while, but I think they're very charming. Well, we're at the end of the tape, and I just really want to thank you.
Well, you're certainly welcome.
It's been delightful. I'm glad we got into the Shenandoah. That was good.
Yeah, I would have.